Most huts love their parties and ceremonies. They make sure everyone kicks up a portion of their credits to the big boss that rules the region, whether as protection money or as tithe. No, Nima demands something bigger. Nima demands eternal service. It's not enough merely to work for her. No. One enters her stable of servants and never leaves. Though she treats herself as if she is a divine worm, born of sand and stone, those who serve her do so because she has set herself up in the middle of everything. A fat spider in the center of a web. A tumor drawing blood flow. She has the resources. She has the access. She controls who may move through the narrow canyons and deep caverns. Nima's power comes from what she controls. She controls resources, and so she controls people. Even still, Sloane wonders if over time those who follow her do so out of some kind of misguided worship. Because the rewards Jakku offers are so few and so meager, you either believe in something greater or die hopeless in the dust. Those who give their lives to her see nothing else for themselves. Serving Nima is literally the best option they have in a world of refuse and ruin. As Nima's long worm body writhes atop the hands of her servants, she speaks a command.
Kumai, Yama the Uncle.
Her voice is hard to take. It's as if someone swallowed broken glass and is trying to shriek through the subsequent throat full of blood. The way her gargled cry echoes through this chamber brings it back to Sloane's ears again and again. The sound of it forces a wave of nausea through her. Sloane knows some Huttese, but this phrase is in a more ancient dialect. It's more ragged, more primitive. Her statement means, what? Come to me? It must, because from underneath, one of her very literal supporters emerges. This one different from the others. A man, similarly shirtless and painted with red streaks of rock dust. His lips are the only part of him that aren't stuck with hooks. Everything else, his wrists, the pads of his palms, the flesh of his arms and of his legs, is pierced with metal. He carries something over his shoulder. From a leather strap hangs a black box and a dented, rusted speaker. A translator device. This servant climbs atop her, draping the translator over the meaty lump that passes for her shoulder. When placed, the box hangs down below her mouth. Then the slave waits, crouching upon the top of her head like a pet waiting the next command.
He looks like a hat,
Sloane thinks absurdly. Nima speaks again.
Manda!
The speaker crackles with static, and then a word emits from it in mechanical, monotone basic.
Speak!
Sloane clears her throat and remembers, be deferential. Huts prefer to be spoken to as if they are not merely sentient, intelligent creatures. They like to be served. They want worship. This one more than others, it seems. Only problem is, Sloane doesn't do the deferential thing very well. Still, she clears her throat and makes a go of it.
Glorious serpent, mistress of sand and stone, Nima the Hutt. I am Grand Admiral Ray Sloane of the Empire. I come today to beseech your help. I and my traveling companion wish to pass through your cavernous territory and on toward the plateau called the Plaintive Hand.
The Hutt interrupts her with a gabble of laughter. The box translates.
Look at you. You are no Grand Admiral.
I assure you, I am. and I will retake my empire. If you allow me to pass through, I will have much to offer you once I regain control.
But she already hears it in her own voice. She's bargaining from a place of weakness. Nima wants to be served, yes, and she wants to be the queen worm. But alternatively, if Sloane has to bow and scrape and act like a wriggling fly trapped on the fat beast's tongue, then she seems weak. Too weak to be taken seriously. She has to be humble while still seeming powerful. This is not something she knows how to do. How to perform is such a living contradiction. How does that even work? Answer: it doesn't. Again, the hut bellows with laughter. She roars in her gargle shriek tongue, and the speaker returns a translation.
You will retake nothing. You have nothing to offer me.
To her servants, the hut screams,
take them, strip them, shear them, have their minds broken.
No, no, no.
It wasn't supposed to go like this. The slaves underneath Nima gently ease her to the stone, and one by one they come for Sloane and Brenton. He flashes her a frightened look, his hands forming into fists. But Sloane gives him a gentle head shake and mouths four words. I can fix this.
Wait,
she says, holding up both hands. The hut slaves do not stop coming, but they slow down, creeping toward her on the balls of their feet, teeth bared, air hissing between them.
Gallius Rax is a pretender to the throne, and he is weak. I will be emperor.
Nima squawks, and the translator box barks.
Hold!
The slaves stop. They freeze in place, as if automatons. They don't even blink. Nima's voice lowers, almost as if she's confiding in Sloane, though the translator box knows no such inflection. When it decodes the response in Basic, it does so in the same mechanized monotone.
I already have a deal with Counselor Rax. You are too late, Grand Admiral.
A deal with Rax? Of course she has a deal. He has to get through her territory somehow. He's given her something, or offered something. Sloane just has to find out what. Once more, the slaves surge toward her, grabbing at her wrists, her jaw, her throat. There's the flash of a blade, and she thinks, don't fight. Wait it out. Keep talking. Keep digging. Then, something turns inside her. She's been on this forsaken planet for months now. She's tired, raw-boned, and in pain. She is an admiral in the Imperial Navy, and the only one deserving of ruling the Empire. I will not be abused anymore. Forget bargaining from weakness. It's time to try the other way. It is time to remember the strength of a Grand Admiral. Sloane roars and throws a punch. Her knuckles connect with the trachea of one of Nima's hut slaves, and he staggers back, clutching at his throat and keening in a high-pitched whine. All her NCB pugilistic training comes back to her, and she adopts a strong stance with one foot behind her and starts swinging as if each punch has to save her life. And she fears that each punch has to do exactly that. Her fists connect. A jaw snaps. A tooth scatters. A slave grabs a hank of her hair, and she traps his arm, twisting it so hard she feels the bone break. The freak screams and drops, writhing like a spider set aflame. They keep coming. She keeps ducking, moving, punching. But she's getting fatigued. Pain throbs at her middle, radiating out like the ripples after a heavy rock hits calm water. The hut screams, and the box translates.
Stop!
Sloane sees Brenton. He is against the ground, his arms bent painfully behind him. blood pools beneath his busted nose. Sloane thinks, forget him. Let him go. He has served his purpose. And yet, a part of her doesn't want to. Loyalty has to count for something. And Sloane doesn't want to be alone. Not yet. Not here. So she waits. She holds up her hands. And it's good that she does. Because more of the hut's servants are crawling down out of the tunnels. Dozens of them now. A few of them with blasters. Many with knives and clubs. All their weapons bound with tendon and bone. I can't fight them all. I just can't. What has Rax offered you? She asks the hut. The hut gargles a reply. The box translates.
We perform work for him. He provides us with weapons, equipment, supplies, whatever I ask.
Work? What work is the hut doing for Rax? That means her role goes beyond merely allowing him passage. Suddenly it dawns on her. What Anchorite Kolob said about children being stolen. What if the Hutt's people are doing the abducting? The Empire needs children. The slave boys advance upon her, slowly, step by step. Their blades swish at the air. Their blasters thrust and point.
Children, she says. You bring him children.
The Hutt says nothing. But that silence is telling.
Did Rax tell you where he's going?
Sloane asks.
Did he tell you what he's doing out there beyond your canyons?
One word responds.
Yeah.
No.
The hut's face betrays the monotone of the translator box. The slug's eye, the one ringed by glittering metal embedded in the flesh, opens wider.
A sign of curiosity,
Sloane thinks. Good. She presses the advantage.
Don't you want to know?
Yeah.
Tell me.
And yet, Sloane hesitates to say more. If she gives this up, she's giving up more than information. What waits out there in the sand is perhaps useful not just to her, but to the whole Empire. The troopers said it was a weapons facility. Sloane dismissed that idea at first. But maybe there really is something there. Rax is no fool. If he wants it, she wants it too. The slaves continue creeping toward her.
They're going to kill me, or turn me into one of them.
She flashes on that. Her and Brenton, bleached white, painted with blood-red dust, kissing the rotten flesh of this wretched slime snake. Their mistress? She tries to imagine the Empire that she will one day rule. And the image of it, once strong in her head, is now a fading picture, like a painting under floodwater. Its colors running, bleaching to the point of oblivion. It's ruined. It's over. There is no Empire.
I'll never be the Emperor of anything. The Hutt is right. I'm no Grand Admiral. I have my revenge, and only that.
That decides it. She hurriedly tells the hut,
what's out there is a weapon. You let me go. You let me get Rax, and you can have it.
The hut dismisses it with a wave of her long-fingered hand, and the slaves advance. Brendan cries out as they smash his face harder into the stone. Sloane feels her blood pulsing in her neck, like a bird trapped in a tightening grip.
She keeps talking. The weapon out there is bigger than any Death Star we've ever built. Imagine it. Imagine it being not in our hands, and not in the hands of the New Republic, but in the hands of the Hutts. Your hands. It is a weapon built for a god. Or a goddess.
It's a deception. She has no idea what the weapon is. Or if it's a weapon at all. But if the lie gets her passage, lets her survive... Nima's hand goes up, quivering fingers splayed out. The hut slaves cease their advance. The words echo louder when the box translates them.
We have a deal, Grand Admiral. You may pass. You will take me to the weapons facility.
Take you? No, I must go alone.
But the hut is already turning around, slithering back toward the tunnels. Her slaves are again struggling to get underneath her, and when they do, they lift her up back toward the nearest chamber. As she slithers forward, the hut says, translated,
Come, Grand Admiral. My temple awaits. First we feast, then at dawn we leave.
Interlude. Feed. Naboo. They call him the old veteran, which is funny because he's only 10 years old. But he's been here longer than all the other kids. Refugees come and refugees go, all from worlds either damaged in war or where the Empire was run off, leaving only chaos in the absence. Some of the children stay for one wave, two, even three. But eventually someone comes, someone fancy, and adopts them. But not Mapo. Mapo, with one ear gone, half his face looking like the business end of a woodworking rasp. The scar tissue, like bad ground, runs up from his jaw over the hole that used to be his ear and to his scalp. The hair doesn't grow there. For a while he tried growing the rest of his hair out and letting it fall over that side like a river going over a waterfall. But the Maven said it just made him look even less approachable. As if such a thing were possible. His arm on that side, too, isn't so good anymore. It's bent and hanging half useless, like the arm of some clumsy blurg. It works, but not well. Now he stands in the plaza of the Catalan, on the far side of the Silver Fountain. Thede is a city of plazas and fountains, but Mapo likes this one the best. The kids call it the Mountain Fountain, what with the way the jets of arcing water make the shape of a mountainous peak. A peak that towers easily over those gathered here in the plaza to watch the tic-tac birds or paint the Gallo Mountains far beyond the capital's margins. Through the spray, he sees a shape sitting on the far side. Just a silhouette blurred by the rush of water.
You can go talk to him,
Kayana says. The young woman is one of the Naboo here. She's a minder, one of those who watch the children.
Nah, it's okay,
Mapo says.
It's fine. He's busy.
I'm sure he'd love to meet you.
She gives him a little shove. He grunts and thinks,
Nobody wants to meet me.
Maybe that's why Kayana is shoving him, because she's shuttling him off to someone else. He heard the minders talking a couple of weeks back, and they said he was a real downer. Still, maybe she's right. And it's not like he has anything else going on. Mapo won't be adopted today. Or tomorrow. Or never, ever, ever. Mapo walks the circumference of the fountain. The wind carries the mist over him, cooling him down. He lets his fingers trail along the stone top of the fountain's border, drawing lines in the water that fast disappear. And then there he is. The Gungan stoops down, sucking a small red fish into his mouth with a slurp. A tongue snakes out and licks the long, beak-like mouth, and the funny-looking figure hums a little and sucks on his fingers. Mapo clears his throat to announce his presence. The Gungan startles.
Oh, hello, Dalu.
Hi,
Mapo says. The two of them stare quietly at each other. The silence stretches. The Gungan has been here as long as Mapo has. Longer, probably. since children started coming in by the shipload as refugees, the Gungan has served them, performing for the kids once or twice a day. He does tricks, he juggles, he falls over and shakes his head as his eyes roll around inside their fleshy stalks. He makes goofy sounds and does strange little dances. Sometimes it's the same performance repeated. Sometimes the Gungan does different things. Things you've never seen. Things you'll never see again. Just a few days ago, he splashed into the fountain's center, then pretended to have the stream shoot him way up in the air. He leapt straight up, then back down with a splash. And he leapt from compass point to compass point, back and forth, before finally conking his head on the edge and plopping down on his butt, shaking his head, tongue wagging. All the kids laughed. Then the Gungan laughed, too. The clown, they call him.
Bring the clown. We want to see the clown. We like it how he juggles glombo shells, or spits fish up in the air and catches them, or how he dances around and falls on his butt.
That's what the kids say. The adults, though, they don't say much about him, or to him. And no other Gungans come to see him either. Nobody even says his name.
My name's Mapo,
the boy says.
Missa Jar Jar!
Hi, Jar Jar.
You sa wantin' some bites?
The Gungan holds up a little red fish and waggles it in the air.
This a pickpock fish? Very good.
No.
Oh, okay then.
And again, silence yawns between them like a widening chasm. The boy can see that the Gungan is older than some of the others he's seen here in Theed. Already Jar Jar's got wiggling chin whiskers dangling. Not hair, but little fish skin protuberances. They dance when he moves, like when he gently brings a fish to his lips. His movement's slow and hesitant, as if he's not sure he should. The Gungan is watching Mapo more than he's watching his fish, though. And suddenly, it slips out of his hand. He tries catching it with his other hand, and the fish slips from his grip there, too. He makes an alarmed squawk, and suddenly his tongue shoots from his puckered lips, capturing the fish midair and launching it into his mouth. Jar Jar winces as a little sound, "Grrrp," comes from him. Mapo laughs. Jar Jar offers a big smile, like he's not even embarrassed by it. It just makes Mapo laugh harder. Jar Jar seems pleased by the sound, as if it's music to him.
Where are you coming from?
Golis Station.
The blank look in the Gungan's eyes tells Mapo that he doesn't know where that is. So Mapo tells him.
It's above Golis. Gas planet in the mid-rim. The Empire was there. They used us as a refueling depot. And when they left, they decided to blow the fuel tanks. I guess so nobody else could have them. Take my toys and go home. That sort of thing. My mom and dad...
Mapo is angry with himself that he can't say it, even after all this time. The words lodge in his chest, and he just looks away.
Oh, no.
Jar Jar shakes his head, looking down in his lap.
That's very sad, Mekin.
Then his eye stalks perk up.
You so wantin' to see a trick?
Mapo arches his one remaining eyebrow.
Okay, sure.
The Gungan chuckles and dips his head in the fountain, filling his face with water. His beak and cheeks bulge. Mapo expects him to spit it out, but he doesn't. Instead, he seems to tighten his body, his neck thickening with tension, and his eyes popping wide. Then, water sprays from the Gungan's flappy ears. As his cheeks shrink, the water comes gushing from each side of Jar Jar's head. Mapo can't help it. He laughs so hard his ribs hurt. Jar Jar doesn't laugh, but he sits back down, looking as satisfied as anybody can get. When the boy is finally done, he wipes the tears from his eyes. Mapo grins.
That was gross.
Jar Jar gives a thumbs up.
Nobody really talks to me,
the boy blurts out.
Is that talking to you?
Yeah, I know. For now. And nobody else does. Nobody even wants to look at me.
Mapo doesn't even feel real sometimes. Like maybe he's just a ghost.
I don't even want to look at me.
Jar Jar shrugs.
I don't know about this talking to Misa, too.
I noticed that. Why don't they talk to you?
I'm not so sure.
The Gungan makes a hmm sound.
Hmm. Misa thinking it's cause of Jar Jar making some uh-oh mistakes. Big mistakes. The Gungan bosses banished me long ago. Misa no been to home in forevers. And Denza he's a Naboo thinking I helped the uh-oh empire.
For a moment, the Gungan looks sad, staring off at an unfixed point. He shrugs.
I don't know.
Though Mapo wonders if he knows more than he's saying.
I don't think you helped the Empire.
Mapo says that without being sure of anything. But he doesn't get the feeling this strange fellow would have done anything like that. Not on purpose. He's just a sweet old clown.
Maybe you just don't belong anywhere. Like me.
Maybe that okey-day.
Maybe it is. Okey-day.
Mapo sighs.
I don't think I'm going anywhere, Jar Jar.
Mine don't go somewhere either.
Maybe we can go nowhere together.
That bomb bad idea!
Oh.
Mapo dips his chin to his chest.
Sorry.
But Jar Jar laughs.
No! Bombad, my smiling! We shall be palos, palo!
The Gungan pats the boy on the head. Mapo doesn't know what's going on, but Bombad must mean good somehow. So he goes with it.
Can you teach me to be a clown, too?
Being clowning is Bombad, too. My teaching you, Sapalo. Risa making the whole galaxy smiling, huh?
Sounds good to me, Jar Jar. And thanks.
Jar Jar gives him a thumbs up and a big grin. Palos indeed. Chapter 10. Night on Chandrilla. Wind eases in through the windows, the curtains blowing, the breeze bringing the smell of sea brine and late summer mist.
Look,
Solo says, the holographic star map floating in the space amid him, Temen, and Sinjir.
Jakku's a dirt world, so that's good. You won't need to find a spaceport. The trick is getting past the blockade and landing somewhere they can't see you.
He swipes the air, and the hologram goes away.
I don't have any good maps of Jakku, but I can tell you most of the place is just dunes and rocks. But the buttes and plateaus lead into canyons, and canyons are a fine place to lose the Empire. He smirks. Trust me, I know. Any bolt hole you can find, take it.
Sinjir watches the smuggler. A smuggler or a hero of the rebellion? Does it even matter anymore? He's about to be a father. That's his role now. And it's driving him nuts by the look of it. Sinjir's seen something similar. Back in the Empire, you'd have officers stationed in faraway places, remote locations, distant bases. Some of them had that glint in their eyes. The wild stare of a Tuca cat someone tried to domesticate. It's the spark of dissatisfaction with your own captivity. Like you're trapped, always imagining a different life. It's important to see that spark, and to know it can turn into full-on steel-melting fire if you aren't careful. Sinjir always knew to look for those around him
with that flash in their eye. It was always they who would betray the Empire. Their wildness made them dangerous. Solos like that. That wildness, some combination of foolhardiness and happy lawlessness, is there behind his stare. He longs for adventure, craves it like some poor souls crave a smear of spice on the tongue. Or a drink on the lips, he thinks. And in this way, it makes sense suddenly that Solo fits so well inside the Rebellion. The Rebel Alliance was just a formalized coalition of criminals seeking to undermine their government. Rebels angry at their captivity, caged as they were by a lack of choices. Though maybe that's Sinjir's lingering Imperial side talking. All this is why Sinjir could never be a father. Solo will eventually find comfort in his captivity. But Sinjir would never find such peace. Settling down just isn't one of his skills. It's why he had to be rid of Condor.
Condor.
His mind suddenly wanders. His heart flutters. And he curses himself. Solo confirms what Sinjir already suspects when the pirate says,
"Now I told you you can take the Falcon, but you'd be a good sight better if you let me captain it. You don't know her like I do. She's finicky."
"I flew it back from Kashyyyk, you know,"
Temen says.
"Not it. Her. Get the Falcon some respect, kid."
"Fine, yeah, okay. I just mean I can fly it. Her."
Right now, it's just the three of them in Leia's apartment overlooking the coast. 10 steps to their right, and they'd be out on the balcony, gazing out over the silver sea. The stars scattered across the night sky, like a million eyes gazing back.
"I'd kill to be out there right now with a jorum of ski in my hand, a little ice in the glass, and nobody to bother me. Condor, foul, traitorous brain, quit your meandering."
He has to bring himself back to the task at hand. Jakku, Nora, Jazz. Fine, yes, the droid, too. And Solo's helping them. He's helping them without Leia knowing, too. She's gone. Probably all night. The princess is with the Chancellor and a spare few others, trying to determine the best course of action for the Empire and Jakku. That path, however, is a political one. Temen and Sinjir have no time for politics. By the time the political machine growls to life and churns out a solution to their problem, Nora and Jazz will be dead. So will Sinjir and Temen. All of life in the galaxy will be dead, because politics is slower than a mud-stuck AT-AT. The plan is simple. Fly in with the Falcon, fast and furious. The plan is also very stupid. Sinjir says,
"Might I offer a contrary suggestion? How about we don't immediately fly a recognizable rebel ship into a starfield filled with the vessels of an enemy fleet? Instead, let me suggest sweet, sweet subterfuge. Those ships are being supplied somehow. We discover their supply line. We sneak aboard a cargo ship or shuttle, costumed in the guise of freight, and we let them deliver us to the surface like a present for a king."
"You want us to hide in a box?" Temen says, scowling.
"Well, when you put it that way, it sounds rather dreadful. But yes, we could hide in a box."
He's about to ask Solo again if maybe, just maybe, the smuggler has a bottle of Corellian rum hidden somewhere in this domicile. The front door opens. The droid, T2LC, steps inside with a servo whine, and following after is Princess Leia. She stops when she sees them. With a sigh, she says,
"I should have known a conspiracy would bloom in my wake."
"Hey," Han says, laughing. "Don't blame me."
"I always blame you."
He says to Sinjir and Temen, sotto voce,
"She really does."
The princess comes and sits down next to her husband. It's fascinating to watch, because usually Leia was all about the formality. Dealing with her sometimes felt icily mechanical, like you were meeting an assassin droid who, quite frankly, had precisely zero increments of time for your foolish human nonsense. Now, though, they're seeing her in the midst of her humanity. At home, tired and pregnant. The heirs of her royalty put aside for a time. Either that, or they're really becoming friends. Leia sits, and her hands move to encircle her belly, settling on the underside. It must be quite a weight. She's getting full, Sinjir thinks. He decides that it must be a horrid thing to carry a child. It's a parasite, basically. Amazing that humans are willing to procreate when this is the burden that results. He's glad he doesn't have to worry about any of that.
You're back early, Han says to her.
I have the kind of heartburn that would drop a tauntaun faster than a Hoth winter, she explains.
Mon is with Oxy now, and Akbar too. They'll be fine.
Here, Solo says, hurrying to his feet. Let me get you a glass of ioxin powder. That'll settle your chest.
No,
she says, waving him off.
Let me just sit. Besides, that stuff tastes like I'm sucking on an Imperial credit.
Her dubious laser-like glare suddenly turns to Temen and Sinjir. The both of them look to each other, like vermin fixed by the stare of a nearby raptor.
I assume you're all cooking up a plan to go to Jakku and rescue Nora and Jazz.
Temen says, obviously unsure how to answer. Sinjir shrugs.
Well, we're not forming a boys' choir. You're not thinking of going along.
That directed at Solo with a thrusting accusatory finger. It's not a question, it's a command.
Me?
Solo says, smirking nervously and offering up both palms in a kind of ha-ha surrender.
I never! You can't get rid of me that easily. I'm here with you, and the little bandit.
To Sinjir and Temen, Leia says,
You could wait, you know. In fact, I'm advising you to wait. The Chancellor will try to move quickly with this, I suspect. Let it play out.
No,
Temen says. The word is sharp and abrupt. He's upset by the idea, that much is clear.
The battle could go on forever. It'll be like a siege. And what if the New Republic doesn't win?
Thanks for your confidence,
Leia says, eyebrows arched. Solo sits back down.
Kid's right.
And just the same, flying through a blockade will be a lot easier when you're not the only ship trying to do it.
She's got a point, too,
Solo says. The boy's face tightens into a stubborn mask. He wants this, and he wants it now. Sinjir can't blame him. The boy, really a young man at this point, has been through considerable trauma. The events on Akiva, on Kashyyyk, and here on Chandrilla with his own father? Sinjir considers himself a bulwark of unsentimentality.
Conda.
But even that would rattle his cage. Temen wants this. Temen needs this. And Sinjir needs it too.
He misses Jazz.
Sinjir fits with her. Like a painting ripped in half, then taped back together again. When he first saw her on the Endor moon, her about to retreat, him covered in Endor dirt and the blood of his fellow Imperials, he saw something in her eyes that just made sense. Absurd, beautiful sense. It's not romantic, of course.
It's something far deeper. Something in their bones.
It's not that they're all that alike, either. Maybe it's better because they're not all that alike.
He'd do anything for her.
Including run an Imperial blockade in a rickety ragdog freighter. He tells them as much.
I fear you won't dissuade us, Princess. Our destiny is a fixed point. We are going to Jakku. Will you stop us?
Leia sighs.
Officially, I have to try.
Blast it.
But,
she adds,
if you have not noticed, I am very, very pregnant. I don't think I realized you could be this pregnant. As such, I consider it entirely possible, likely even, that tomorrow morning I won't be up early, because tonight will be characteristically sleepless. Which means, If you try to escape in the Falcon before dawn, I might miss the chance to stand in your way, which would be a shame. So please, do me the favor and leave later in the day.
Sinjir grins at her.
Message received, Your Highness.
But the bigger smile comes from Solo. His face is damn near cut in half by the grin that spreads. It's like he's proud of her. He leans in and kisses her cheek.
And that, Sinjir decides, is that. In the morning, Jakku calls.
Temin pushes along a couple of crates on a grav lift. Up over the landing platform, he spies the edge of the sea and the searing laser line of morning sunlight burning along it. From the other side of the platform comes a familiar face. Sinjir. The ex-Imperial crosses the platform, walking in long, sleepy strides
and yawning as he does.
They join up and walk side by side toward Hangar 34.
Sinjir yawns again.
It's disgustingly early.
Did you sleep?
Of course.
Really?
If by sleep you mean sat up in bed reading a book and sipping tea, then yes, I slept.
Temin gives him a look.
And by tea you mean rum?
Psst, no. I'm out of rum. This was proper Chandrillan Rava.
You always find something new to drink, don't you?
Variety is a vital component of a happy life.
Are you drunk right now?
I am a professional. I do not get drunk, I get pickled.
Temin gives him another look. This one so fierce he likes to imagine blaster bolts coming from his eyes and knocking that smug look off Sinjir's face. The one-time loyalty officer rolls his eyes.
Come now.
I stopped partaking around midnight. Then I gathered supplies and... His words drift.
Then what?
And we have company.
Ahead, the hangar bay awaits. In it, a ship hides under a massive blue tarp. A ship shaped a good bit like the Millennium Falcon. Crossing in front of that ship are two Senate guards. Red helmets, white plumage. Batons at their side, hands waiting, as if ready to draw them. More footsteps reach Temin's ears. He looks left and right. More guards. Two coming up on each side.
What is going on?
Temin asks in a low voice.
Just keep walking,
Sinjir says.
Leia send these guys?
I hope not, or we miscalculated in trusting her. Hand on your hip.
He means hand on your blaster. Temin has a small pistol hanging there under the hem of his shirt. His fingers feel along the holster, drifting to the grip. These are Senate guards, and he hopes this is all above board. But everything seemed okay on Liberation Day, too. Until it wasn't.
Stop there, sir,
one of the guards ahead says, one hand out peacefully, but the other idly fingering that baton at his hip. It's a threat. Subtle, but a threat just the same.
Do you know who we are?
Sinjir asks, chin up, nose down. He has engaged full-bore, haughty prig mode.
Well, do you?
You are Sinjir Rath Velis, and that is Temin Wexley.
Oh.
The ex-Imperial looks like someone popped his bubble.
Yes, that's us then. What is this all about?
The lead guard stares out over a smashed flat nose with steely eyes.
You're to turn around and return to your quarters.
We have business with our ship, Temin says. So move.
The guard's hand tightens around the baton.
The ship in that hangar belongs to General Solo.
He's not a general anymore, and he's letting us borrow it.
Her!
Be that as it may, we have strict orders, and those orders are to ask you to turn around and go on your way.
You asked, Sinjir says, and we decline. Like the boy said, move.
Sir, I don't want this to get ugly.
Have you seen your face, guardsman? Too late to wish for pretty.
Temin feels the other guards. All four of them encroach tighter behind them, even as those in front grab their batons.
Sir, we have orders.
Whose orders?
Temin asks.
Who's keeping us here?
The Chancellor herself.
Sinjir and Temin looked to each other. Both of their faces wore with the question, is this real? They're both suspicious.
Temin steps up, shirt pulled up, blaster revealed.
Guard, you better move now, or me and my friend here...
We'll leave peacefully, Sinjir says,
pulling Temin back sharply.
He protests, but Sinjir shushes him and continues.
We didn't mean to step out of line, and please assure the Chancellor we are returning to our quarters.
Temin tries to pull out of Sinjir's grip, but the man's eyes meet his. There's an intensity there, and a message.
That message is,
let it go.
The boy grits his teeth.
He wants to charge past them,
but he doesn't. He lets it go. As they hurry away, Temin hisses.
What was that?
I don't know, Sinjir says, but we're going to find out.
Where are we going?
Where else? We have no other friends here. We have to see Leia.
Leia. Her name, spoken in the dark.
Luke!
She reaches for him, but doesn't find him.
The dark, now lit with stars.
One by one, like eyes opening. Comforting at first, then sinister as she worries.
Who is out there? Who is watching us?
Hands reach for her. Hands of shadow, lifting her up, reaching for her throat, her wrists, her stomach.
Inside, the child kicks. She feels her baby turning inside, right side up and upside down, struggling to find his bearings, trying so hard to find his way free of her.
It's not time, she thinks. Just a little longer. Leia.
Luke!
She wants to cry out, but her words won't come. Her mouth is sealed. A hand pressed over it. One by one, stars go dark again, winking out of existence as if by a hand slowly closing over them.
Leia!
She gasps and wakes.
Han. It's just Han.
He's by the side of the bed, rousing her, gently shaking her shoulder. The dream recedes like a wave going back to sea.
Hi,
she says, her mouth tacky, her eyes full of sleep. Her middle twists, too. It's not the baby. It's some unseen fear uncoiling. The remnants of the dream haunt her, but they break apart like a sandcastle as she sits up and clears her head, doing as Luke taught her to do.
Breathe in, breathe out. Be mindful of the world, the galaxy, and your place within it. Everything will be okay. The Force will be your guide.
You sleep like the dead these days, he says.
And probably snore like a Gamorrean.
She blinks and regards him. He's fully dressed. That means he's been up for a while. She senses something coming off him. A restlessness. A fear of settling down that only leaves him more unsettled.
An image forms clear in her mind.
Chewbacca. Han misses his co-pilot. And why wouldn't he? Those two have been together for so long, he should probably be married to that lovable hairsuit instead of her.
It's early. You're awake.
He's always slept like a scoundrel. One eye open, ready for whatever may come. He said he used to sleep in fits and starts whenever he could grab a little shut-eye. And he has a hard time calling this place home. Home for him has always been the Falcon.
Even still, he's not a morning person. But since Kashyyyk, since saying goodbye to Chewie, this is how he's been.
He goes to bed after her, wakes up before her, like an animal in a cage, pacing, pacing.
But today, a new feeling. He's worried.
You need to see something,
Han says.
Can it wait?
I don't think it can, sweetheart.
HoloNet News. It's been a long night, and Mon Mothma thought they had gotten somewhere. If the Empire was on Jakku, she had to take careful, measured steps to see the shape of the threat that awaited them. That meant sending probe droids to scout. Maybe a ship built for stealth, flown by one of their best pilots. It meant trying to see if they had anybody at all on Jakku who could report in. Seeing what was going on in orbit didn't give a sense of what was happening on the ground. Was it an occupation? Were they even on the surface? Could they be looking for something? Or someone? Now all the careful planning, all their consideration, gone. Shattered. There on the holoprojector stands Tolwar Wartol. He, like other Orishin, has smooth skin, peppered with uneven, asymmetrical, disconnected plates. The plates are smooth and catch the light like black mirrors. The HoloNet is presently replaying a speech he just gave here on Chandrilla, down in the Eleutherian Plaza. His supporters gathered to hear him. He spoke with passion, his nose slits flaring, his bisected lower jaw giving his mouth the look of a blooming flower whenever he hit the speech's talking points. And oh, what a speech it was. Mon, Oxy, and Akbar had all settled their plan and were, just before sunset, ready to break for the day and attempt to catch a few scant hours of sleep before putting actions in motion to study the Empire more. Then a call came in from Sandeev Sela.
You need to turn on HoloNet News.
The first thing Wartol said to the crowd, and to the civilized galaxy, thanks to the reach of the network, was this.
The Empire has been found!
With those words spoken, Mon's heart froze in her chest.
What? How? How could he know?
Presently, HoloNet News is repeating his speech. This is the third go-round. His name is trending, his popularity surging. On the screen, Senator Wartol is saying,
Chancellor Mon Mothma has discovered where the bulk of the Imperial forces are hiding, and it is on a distant world near the unknown regions, a world called Jakku.
Then comes the accusation.
You did not know this information, and I did not know it either, because the Chancellor has been sitting on that information, nesting upon it, like a serpent hoarding precious treasure. Why didn't she say anything? What did she plan to do with this knowledge? If the New Republic is to be free of corruption, offering a government that belongs to the galactic citizens, should there not be total transparency and accountability? Secrets separate us. I would seek to demolish that wall of secrets, my friends. We must be partners in this.
The crowd cheers. Joyous rhetoric from a man painting himself as the savior. Everyone likes to be sold easy promises, don't they? He goes on to outline his plans for the chancellorship. Transparency, a strong central military, and policies that will ensure everyone's voice will be heard.
We see the Empire now, and we must act. The Chancellor wishes for us to sit on our hands. And every moment she waits, the Empire grows stronger, like an infection we thought had been beaten back. If we do not intensify the cure, the disease will return. It will attack once more, just as it attacked on Chandrilla. Can we afford to pursue peace before the war is done? Can we afford such soft hands steering our nascent democracy? I think not, my friends.
Turn it off,
the Chancellor says. Oxy does.
Preposterous!
Akbar announces, gruffer and louder than usual. It was only recently that the Chancellor resumed even speaking to Akbar. He and Leia both are still somewhat political pariahs for their actions on Kashyyyk. Though that effort secured the New Republic a much-needed win, it still painted them as iconoclasts,
Rebels, ironically. Now, though, she's thankful to have Akbar here. He remains a voice of stability and sanity. He goes on.
You had this information for less than a standard day. It would be impossible, not to mention unethical, to immediately tell the galaxy what has been discovered. Chaos would ensue.
Chaos will ensue, Oxy says. Thanks to the senator from Orish.
And none of this explains how he even knows, Mon points out.
She fears the worst. Someone close to her is the leak. But who? Oxy has been here nearly the whole time, taking only a few breaks to pick up food or check on her children or her Tuca cat. Could she be the leak?
Certainly it wouldn't be Akbar.
Though he did go against her with Kashyyyk. Could he slyly be supporting Senator Wartol's bid for Chancellor? That seems unlikely. The Mon Cala Admiral is a warrior, yes, but a warrior committed to peace in their time. War is a means to an end, but the way Wartol talks, it is the persistent and never-ending means. He sees peace being maintained by a strong military, and a willingness to deploy it freely, even after the Empire is gone. Mon wants a coalition of militaries, an alliance-driven pact of peace that systems could join to support one another when danger encroaches. Akbar supports that dream.
That leaves who? Leia? Han?
No. The boy, Temin, and the ex-Imperial? Could be. They certainly wanted to take swift action. The boy in particular may be suffering from the impetuousness and naivete of youth. His mother is gone. His father, the foe who almost killed her. Certainly a young man like that could be drawn in by a figure like Wartol. She reminds herself to keep a wary eye there. Perhaps that boy should not be trusted. She tries to flex her fist again. Mon's connection to her own fingers is soft and distant, as if they belong to someone else. She erupts suddenly, a fit of forced optimism.
This is all normal. These are the necessary bumps and scratches of a growing democracy. We should not expect politics to be neat and tidy, and we are reminded of that today. Enough looking back. Now we look forward.
We have to respond, Oxy says.
And soon, I fear,
Akbar adds.
It seems that even a few hours of sleep are no longer in our equation,
Mon says with a beleaguered sigh.
I shall begin working on my response immediately. Oxy, contact HoloNet News. Have them ready for my statement. And Admiral?
I will initiate the probe droid and scout immediately,
he says with a brusque nod.
Good. Let's remain vigilant. We have a long day ahead of us, and I fear that traitors are afoot.
Chapter 11.
Everything moves fast as light speed. Fast until it stops, like a ship plowing into the side of an asteroid.
It wasn't the Chancellor,
Leia tells them, taking a cup of tea from her protocol droid.
Thank you, Elsie.
Sinjir cocks an eye at her. He's angry. Irrationally so, perhaps. He likes to keep things cool. He imagines his heart is less an organ beating blood into his body, and more a collection of icicles hanging from the chin of some malevolent snow beast. But he can keep that veneer no longer. He knows full well that running off like a soggy, drunk adventurer into the crushing maw of the Empire's fleet was not a wise decision. And a little part of him is thankful they're not right now being blasted to bits by a super star destroyer in the space above Jakku. But the rest of him seethes over the fact that Nora and Jazz are still down there somewhere. Hopefully alive. And nobody coming for them the way they have come for others. Lucky, perhaps, that Temin isn't here. Sinjir sent the boy to see the pilot, Wedge Antilles. Wedge might know how to get them to Jakku.
Then it was you, Sinjir accuses. You blocked us.
Leia gives him an incredulous look.
Do you truly believe me so duplicitous, Sinjir?
Yes.
He frowns and shakes his head. No, I don't know. Someone sent those guards. They didn't send themselves. Han passes behind